The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've got a lot to get to on today's program. Coming up in the next segment, we'll be having a study, just building on basically what I concluded with on yesterday's program, the subject of courage, using a couple of examples. Winston Churchill, as I mentioned toward the end of yesterday's show, and then also continuing with our study of some Old Testament personalities, we'll focus in on Joshua and how he was noted for courage. You see a lot about that in the book of Joshua from the Old Testament. So we'll be getting to that, as well as some other items, particularly in the news. All of these hotspots, these troubled areas in Israel, dangers on the horizon. That's a headline coming from Geopolitical Futures. And then there's another one from The New Yorker. Egypt is in trouble. Those are some troubled hotspots in the Middle East. And, of course, some of the latest headlines have to do with North Korea. Once again, they broke out of their two-month lull yesterday in a pretty spectacular way. This is the most advanced intercontinental ballistic missile that they've fired off yet. It traveled just a distance over 600 miles, but it was the height of this firing that captured the attention of the Pentagon and of all nations, really. 2,500 miles. North Korea state media says that it can carry these intercontinental ballistic missiles, can carry what they call super large heavy warheads. And most analysts here in the UK, in the United States, they're saying now that they have the capability, North Korea does, to reach any city inside the United States, not just the West Coast, any city. That's what they're saying. American, again, defense experts corroborate, saying the potential range here could be upwards of 8,000 miles. Some are saying the technology is there for them to fire a missile some 10 to 12,000 miles. Again, hitting any part of the mainland United States. This is what the Defense Secretary Jim Mattis had to say yesterday. This is clip one.
A little over 2.5 hours ago, North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile. It went higher, frankly, than any previous shot they've taken. It's a research and development effort on their part to continue building ballistic missiles that could threaten everywhere in the world, basically. And in response, the South Koreans have fired some pinpoint missiles out into the water to make certain North Korea understands that they could be taken under fire by our ally. But the bottom line is it's a continued effort to build a threat, a ballistic missile threat that endangers world peace, regional peace, and certainly the United States.
This is the way of the world. Just imagine what happens when Iran gets this kind of technology. They're not that far from it. The missile capabilities, the nukes to go with it, they've already threatened Europe. Iran, I mean. But missiles that can reach, as General Mattis said yesterday, that can reach anywhere in the world, a threat to any place in the world, basically. That's what he was saying there. And so now commentators are coming forward, wondering about America's anti-missile capabilities, or Japan's, or South Korea's. And these missiles, I mean, they continue to be lobbed over Japan, and they're not fired upon or fired down. And there's an article at Defense One that says the reason for this is because we can't shoot them down. The number one reason that we don't shoot down North Korea's missiles is that we cannot. That's from Defense One just today. Japan can't do it. The United States can't do it. South Korea can't do it. They're too high. As I said, here again, the height of this one yesterday or last night, 2,500 miles. What a threat. And what is the United States going to do about it? Well, here's a short statement from President Trump just last night as well, clip two.
A missile was launched a little while ago from North Korea. I will only tell you that we will take care of it.
That's all that we can know, is that the United States will take care of it. But that's not saying much, as this back and forth now has gone on for months. The rhetoric, the war of words, and then the missiles. The missiles, they keep firing the missiles. The national interest weighed in this morning. After a months-long lull in activity, North Korea test-launched an intercontinental ballistic missile on what appears to have been a lofted trajectory. According to the Pentagon, the weapon flew for a distance of 1,000 kilometers before splashing down near Japan. It says initial assessments indicate that the missile was an intercontinental ballistic missile. Well, that's quoting from a Pentagon spokesman, and it gives some of the specs on how far that it went, where it landed. It says that means that the missile flew a high lofted trajectory out into space, well above the orbit of the International Space Station, before coming back down after its roughly 53-minute journey. 53 minutes it's in the air, passing the International Space Station. That's no wonder we can't shoot this kind of a missile down. It says here, while it should have been apparent to everyone after North Korea's July 28th launch that Pyongyang now possesses a weapon that can strike directly at the U.S., this latest missile test removes any doubt that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has the capacity to hold the American homeland at risk. That holds true even if the North Korean weapon has not yet been perfected. I mean, even if not perfected, this latest firing, it puts all of America at risk of being hit. This is a major development, it says. This is quoting a geopolitical analyst. Their third successful ICBM test with the longest potential range yet. It appears to have the potential to go 13,000 miles, depending on the weight of the warhead. So somewhere between 8 and 13,000 miles. That's the range on this. But notice what it says. This national interest piece. It says, while some had assumed that external pressure from the U.S. and its allies had convinced North Korea to hold off on testing, arms control experts never bought that line of reasoning. It says, while the outlook is bleak, there is a potential silver lining. Here's the silver lining. North Korea might be nearing the completion of its test series. That could mean that there might be some potential for a diplomatic solution. So that's what we're holding our hopes out for. Now that they've got the technology, now that they've issued all the threats, now that they're firing missiles over Japan that are going 2,500 miles up into the air, now that they have the nuclear bomb, now that they have all these weapons of mass destruction, now, maybe now, we can finally sit down at the negotiating table and figure out some kind of diplomatic solution. What does the Bible say about the ambassadors of peace and what they do in the end? What does your Bible say about when they come saying, peace, peace, what's next? I mean, even as the missiles are flying, you have them talking about diplomacy and settling this. And commentators, of course, blaming this situation on President Trump, of all people, who's been in office for some 10 months. Well, it's because he's had some tough words for North Korea, or because he's made fun of the North Korean leader, mocking his appearance or whatever. That's the reason. That's why there's so much hostility. That's why there's so much hatred. That's why there's all these threats. No one's talking about human nature. No one's talking about Bible prophecy. No one's talking about what Jesus Christ said would be prevalent in the days leading right up to the return, his return to this earth. Here again, this national interest piece, it says one possible positive sign in this test. Here's the positives, and see if you can, see if you're excited about hanging your hat on this. North Korean Foreign Minister Ray said at the UN in September that they were finally only a few steps away from the final gate of completion of the state nuclear force. That could mean they intend to conduct one or two more missile tests and then declare their nuclear deterrent complete. This is quoting the geopolitical analyst in this article. And he says, finally, that could finally open the door to negotiations. A door we should have walked through long ago, before they had a nuclear-armed ICBM that could hit any part of the United States. A door we should have walked through long ago. Well, that's all we were doing in the 1990s, was talking and negotiating. And then they break out with the bomb. It's as if they forget the history. They forget what led up to this. And then now they're still saying, look, we've got to negotiate. We've never really tried it. Well, yes, we have, actually. So how do you fix this? What's the solution? It's pretty amazing. My father's latest booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. How timely is that? How timely is that booklet? It just came out in October. Earlier this year, he had the program on the Matthew 24 prophecy. That was from May of 2017. Some of that material then converted into that new booklet. If you haven't gotten it yet, make sure you request. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. You can request a free copy at the trumpet.com website. But notice what my father said back in that program, May 5th, 2017. Here's clip three.
The regime has openly declared that it is racing to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach the United States and thus destroy an American city at a Kim Jong-un push of a button.
That's my father from May 5th, 2017. He was quoting Charles Krauthammer there. That's many months ago, talking about this regime, this maniacal regime, racing to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach the U.S. and thus destroy any American city. And now, according to this expert at the National Interest, now that they finally have it, now that they finally can do it, I guess they're ready to talk about peace. Notice what else my father had to say, going back to that May 5th program. This is clip four.
Now, if that isn't a problem that disturbs you, well, I think it should. It should disturb all of us, because this is the real world, and this man hates America and is threatening us with a war. And he's a madman with nuclear weapons.
That's the thing. I mean, he's a madman. And he has nuclear weapons. He's a tyrant. His people are suffering. He's serving himself. He's not going to sit and listen to negotiations. He's not going to dismantle his arsenal. But going back to the first part of that clip, my father says that, look, this is something that ought to disturb us. But that's just the thing. I mean, we've been hearing these warnings for so long. I mean, they go back to the 1990s. And now we're at a critical stage. Now the capability's there. All the talk about building the weapon and then building the delivery system, it's here. The weapon is there. The missile is there. The capability is there. But this alarm has been sounding for so long, well, we just kind of get numb to it and we tune it out. And we turn to our gadgets. Or we go to sleep spiritually. I heard Mark Levin, the radio host, yesterday talking about the coming economic collapse. He had something to say about it in one of his books. He was paraphrasing from what he wrote. And he said, look, I put all this time and effort into into writing down this warning message, words to that effect. He didn't use that exact language. But he said, look, I've been sounding the alarm on this coming economic crash, and nobody cares. Nobody's paying attention. I mean, that's coming from one of the more popular talk radio hosts in the United States. That's his take. What is wrong with people? Why won't they sit up and take note? Why won't they listen? Why don't they listen in Washington? Why do they keep spending and spending and spending and then talking, in the case of the economy, and then talking about, well, if we just slash taxes, that'll help corporations so that they can create more jobs, and then the economy will get bigger and we'll be able to pay our bills. Never, never, never is there any talk of slashing spending. That is never an option. It's just spend, spend, spend. And I went through a couple of stories yesterday or the day before. You look at, I mean, this is the way Americans spend. It's not just a problem in Washington. The consumer debt, the credit card debt, the student loan bills. All of that's going to come back upon us. In fact, there was another article at Defense One just today about the cost, the tremendous cost, just the financial cost for all of these wars that the United States has been involved in this century. The post-9/11 war debt, it could come to $8 trillion. The war debt coming in now from, I mean, we had to finance these wars. We had to borrow to fight these wars. Iraq, Afghanistan. And it could amount to about $8 trillion in interest payments in coming decades, according to Defense One. We have to recognize, it says, that we've been borrowing for 16 years to pay for military operations. That's according to Senator Jack Reed, the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. It says, it's the first time really in history with any major conflict that we have borrowed rather than ask people to contribute to the national defense directly. And the result is we've got this huge fiscal drag. And, of course, the way that they're coming at it here in this piece is that this is not the time to slash taxes. So they're using this tremendous, this massive war debt to argue for, well, what they want politically. We can't cut taxes. We've got to raise taxes. We've got to raise taxes on the rich. Of course, that's not a popular message with the people that have to pay the taxes. But how do you fix this? I mean, these are sobering realities. These are earth-shaking problems, and no one seems to care, as Mark Levin said yesterday. You think about that prophecy in Leviticus 26 in verse 20, saying that our strength, I mean, that massive amount of military strength spent in vain. What do we have to show for it in Afghanistan and Iraq? We've handed Iraq to Iran. And now the tab comes in, $8 trillion. What do we have to show for all of this effort, for all of this war, for all of this fighting? There's not much to show for it except for a heavy price tag. Whether you look at it in terms of blood or money. Switching back here to North Korea. Again, notice what my father had to say. This is from that May 5th, 2017 program, clip 5.
But look at this world. Korea is only one of many nuclear powers, and they share their nuclear arsenal with Iran, which is the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the world, led by, some very unstable leaders. What is this time that we're entering into called the times of the Gentiles in the Bible? Daniel called this the crisis of crises. This is the crisis of man's history on this earth. The crisis.
That's what we're coming into. The crisis. Here is a madman presiding over a nation in Southeast Asia. with all of these mass destruction weapons, and he's happy to share his technology, his arsenal with Iran. And they happen to be the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the world. And they, too, are head by, well, I mean, that's putting it nicely, an unstable leader. What are we heading into? Look at the world, as he said there at the start of that clip. Look at the world today. Look at all of the trouble. This article that I mentioned about Israel, it says that, okay, ISIS is, it's been crushed now. It's no longer a threat. You've got the same government there in Syria. I mean, and that was never, ever a friend of Israel to begin with. But Syria's been preoccupied with fighting ISIS. A lot of the nations of this world have been preoccupied with ISIS and the Syrian civil war and Iraq and so on. Well, now that the dust has settled on that, now that Iran controls Iraq, now that they're building this land bridge between Iran and the Mediterranean, what does this mean? What's next for the Middle East? How will this impact Israel? This article from Jacob Shapiro talks about Israel being relatively strong and secure at the moment, but that it might not stay that way. He says that the U.S.-Israeli relationship, it's not as strong as it once was. Talks about the power in Turkey and Iran, its sphere of influence, and how Israel's got to play this delicate game, surrounded by enemies. It says no single relationship is going to fix all of Israel's problems. Israel is strong now, but danger is on the horizon. I mean, why is it that you everywhere that you look, you see danger on the horizon, whether it's North Korea or Iran or Egypt? Another article here from the New Yorker. I mean, the terrorist hotbed for the last several years, it's been there in Syria and Iraq. And they've had their strikes, of course, in Europe and the United States, too. But now that it's died down in Iraq, this New Yorker piece is saying, you better watch out for the Sinai Peninsula. Egypt controls that. It says, since 2013, terrorism has increasingly disrupted life in Egypt, especially in the Sinai. The Egyptian hinterland has witnessed more than 1,700 attacks over the past 4 years. The Sinai province, the local ISIS affiliate, has claimed credit for some 800 of them. Lately, the attacks have been creeping closer to Cairo and targeting more civilians. And it mentions that attack, that brutal attack just last Friday, several hundred killed, a massive terrorist attack. And it's just one of the latest and one of the many challenges facing the Egyptian president. Well, as we've been saying for so long, this instability in Egypt, eventually, and we've already seen the short-term leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood following the Arab Spring in 2011, and the military has now regained control. But how long is that going to hold? I think of that article by Richard Palmer years ago where it talks about how that these changes, particularly these prophesied dramatic changes that we talk about, how that it doesn't always happen just with a snap of a finger or overnight, but over time. I mean, if these terrorist attacks are getting closer and closer to Cairo, how much longer before Egypt swings over into the Iranian camp? That's coming. That's prophesied. You can read about it in Daniel 11, in Psalm 83. But everywhere you look, you see, it's like you see the crisis of crises. The crisis of man's history, my father said. I mean, look at this world and consider then what Jesus said in Matthew 24 about great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be. Christ, in this chapter, he's interpreting the seven seals of Revelation. And this particular passage, or these particular verses, verses 21 and 22, are talking about They're talking about the fifth seal, Great Tribulation. Great Tribulation, that's prophesied. Notice what Herbert Armstrong said on one of his old radio programs, clip 6.
And all Bible students know that this Great Tribulation is yet in the future. It is yet to come. It isn't something that happened way back there in biblical history long, long ago. The Great Tribulation is a future event. And Jesus explains it in Matthew 24 as a time of trouble such as never has existed on this earth since there was a nation, nor ever shall be.
That's Mr. Armstrong saying that, look, if you're a student of Bible prophecy, you know this is for the future. You know that this hasn't happened yet. A time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, the prophet Daniel says. And except those days should be shortened, Jesus says here in Matthew 24, there should no flesh be saved alive. God has to shorten the days. God has to send his son to this earth. God has to forcibly intervene. Otherwise, we'd just destroy ourselves. Now look at the world, like my father said in that clip. Look at North Korea. Look at Iran. Look at the turmoil in Europe. Look at what it's leading to, the strongman to come out of Europe. Look at the trouble in the UK. Look at the trouble in the United States. Look at the crushing amount of debt that the United States is in. And yet no one seems to care. Just put it on the tab. Just charge it to the credit card. Just run up the debt. Run up the debt. Slash taxes. Spend like never before. Steal from Social Security, Medicare, all of those programs. There's nothing in them except IOUs. There's no so-called fund, trust fund. There's nothing like that. Everything's been spent. The Treasury's been raided. These are the problems that we're facing because of human government, or to be more precise, because of human nature. There is no hope in man. There is no solution in human government. The only solution is God. The only hope for the future. The Apostle Peter wrote about this in his two epistles. The only hope is in God and the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, we'll get into that study, that Bible study on spiritual courage. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So right at the tail end of yesterday's program, I just mentioned this example in William Manchester's book about Winston Churchill and how that as a young man, he really did want to establish or gain a reputation of, as he said, of personal courage. He had been a coward, he said, in school. And so as he became a young man, he was eager to rush to the front lines. And a lot of his critics at the time said that, well, he's just doing it to further his political ambitions. And it's true, he didn't want to be a lifelong soldier. He did want to work in the House of Commons. He did want to become prime minister. But he did run to the front lines as well. He sought out those most dangerous, contentious fights. India, Egypt, South Africa. He was fighting for empire. Manchester quotes, or rather says about him, apart from its political value, physical courage had an intrinsic value in his eyes, Churchill's eyes, and the lack of it was shameful. People used to think that, if you can believe it. It's hard to view the society today, young people today, and say, wow, I mean, look at the courage there. Instead, you see a lot of shameful acts, a lot of cowardly acts, people who look down on the military or on government or on the people in positions of authority. Churchill, though, I mean, you look at the way he was as a young man there in the late 1890s, and then when you fast forward 40 years or so, it was the people of Britain who, albeit reluctantly, who called on Churchill, who relied on the courage of Winston Churchill to deliver them from their darkest hour. So by that point, I mean, he had been in the House of Commons. He was now Prime Minister. And yet still, you could say he rushed to the front lines, figuratively speaking, to face Adolf Hitler, to face the tyrant, to face the madman. No one else would do it. Everyone else tried to appease Hitler. And even once Hitler made his intentions obviously known, as he started his rampage across Europe, there were those who wanted to make some kind of a peace deal with the madman. What an example of courage, as I said at the start of the program. There's plenty of others in the Bible, particularly with respect to Joshua. When you think about this young, courageous lieutenant, this faithful assistant to Moses, Moses' minister, as it says in the opening verses of the book of Joshua, God told Joshua to rise up and to lead the people of Israel into the land of promise. Now, that was a daunting task because that land of promise was full of enemies. And so God had to encourage Joshua. God had to strengthen Joshua. Joshua 1 and verse 5 says, "There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you nor forsake you." This is God and his admonition, his instruction to Joshua. It says, "Be strong and of good courage. For unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land, which I swear unto their fathers to give them." Be strong and courageous. Be bold. Make a bold and courageous stand for God. Stake your life on the promises of God. Walk by faith. He did that. And of course, he mixed faith with action. That's not something you see in the world of traditional Christianity. Faith, to so many, is just a shallow form of belief. Belief in Christ. Faith needs to be mixed with works. That's from James 2. If you look at the marginal reference there about dividing their inheritance, unto this people you shall divide their inheritance, it says in the margin of the King James Version, you shall cause this people to inherit the land. You're going to be the cause, Joshua. You're going to be the leader. You're going to be the catalyst. And verse 7, it says, only be you strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. It takes courage to obey God, to stand up for God's way of life. It takes courage to fight for God. You look at the end of that book, Joshua 23, or near the end, verse 6. Here again it says, "Be you therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that you turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left." See, Joshua, he followed the instructions of Moses to a T. He carried out Moses' wishes, even while Moses was in the grave. Joshua 10, verse 25, notice this, it says, "And Joshua said to him, Fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus shall the Lord do to all your enemies against whom you fight." See, facing down and conquering all of these enemies in the promised land, it was going to take a lot of courage, a willingness to fight for God. He was going to need to be fearless, and he was. I mean, half the book, really. Nearly half the book of Joshua is devoted to just nothing except the conquests, the fighting, in other words, the struggle to get into the promised land. And what does it say over in the New Testament? It says that through tribulation we enter into the kingdom of God. It's not an easy road. We've got to fight our way in, spiritually speaking. Just like Joshua did, just like the people of Israel did anciently. Joshua 11, verse 15. Notice this, it says, "And the Eternal commanded Moses his servant." As the Eternal commanded Moses his servant, so did Moses command Joshua. You see the progression. This is God's family government. From God down to Moses, and then on through Moses to Joshua. The same truth, the same foundation, the same courageous acts, the same faith. As God commanded Moses, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. And he left nothing undone of all that the Eternal commanded Moses. How about that? What an attitude. Look at the obedience. So Joshua took all that land. This is in Joshua 11. He took all that land, the hills, and all the south country, and all the land of Goshen, and the valley, and the plain, and the mountain of Israel, and the valley of the same. Even from the Mount Halak, it says. That goes up to Seir, even unto Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, under Mount Hermon, or Hermon, and all their kings he took and smote them and slew them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. He didn't just waltz right in. It took 6 or 7 years to conquer Canaan. And it says in verse 19, "There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon, all others they took in battle." So every single city except for one fought against Israel, fought against Joshua. Everywhere that Joshua turned, there was resistance, there was confrontation, there was a struggle, there was fighting. But he just carried on with Moses' instructions. Everything that Moses had commanded, that's what he did. My father gave a program a little over a year ago on the former prophets, referring to this example of Joshua and his courage. And here's what he had to say.
Joshua, see, was a warrior. He fought wars for God. And he learned to trust God implicitly in fighting those wars. And 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 15 says that the battle is not yours, but God's. Now, Joshua understood that. He knew that. And you and I have to know that as well. That's a foundational lesson. The battle is not yours. It's God's if you're trusting God. He fights our battles for us. We're soldiers. It says in 2 Timothy 2, we're soldiers for Jesus Christ, and we're in a spiritual war. Many people will say, well, look, I'm too weak to do this. I'm too weak to follow God. But look, we're all too weak to follow God. Every single one of us. The primary lesson is learn, like Joshua, to trust God to fight your battles. And he did it consistently and just consistently won battles and ended up winning the war and giving them peace and rest in the promised land.
That's a great explanation there of how we fight with God. God gives us the victory. The battle, ultimately, the battle is the Lord's. It is God's. But we have to fight. We have to be courageous and bold for God. We have to walk in His ways. I mentioned that in class this morning as we were going through Ephesians 2, verses 8 to 10. We're saved by grace through faith. And that not of ourselves. It's a gift from God, the faith of Jesus Christ. It's a gift that comes from God. And then it goes on to say, Paul explains, it's not just saved by grace and no faith or works. Or grace alone, faith alone without the works. Paul goes on to say, we are his workmanship. And then he says, we're to walk in these ways. I mean, God is the one who's fashioning us. He's molding us. He's creating us into a God being. But we have to walk in the ways of God. You see that in the example of Joshua, same with Winston Churchill, you know, in a carnal sense, I mean. But in Joshua, I mean, you talk about a man of action. Okay, he received all of these instructions from Moses, and he followed them to a T. And he went in and took the promised land. He went in and he conquered Canaan, and he encountered resistance every single place except one little city. Verse 23 here, I think this is chapter 11, it says, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord said unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. And the land rested from war. See, Joshua was the cause, as we noted when going through chapter 1. He was the cause. He was the one that brought it about. As God was leading him, of course. My father wrote in Malachi's message to God's church today, he said, it appears that the Joshua of Moses' time had one outstanding strength, spiritual courage. God was instructing him to use this quality, showing him how much he would need it. And then he goes on to say how that spiritual courage may be the greatest need that we have today. I mean, you look at what's happened to God's church in these last days. So many people have just, well, they've just weakened spiritually and they've just gone along with the world. They're just following along after the world, just like I pointed out yesterday with respect to the royal family here in the UK. Just going along with the ways and the customs of the world, not standing firm for the laws of God, or for the Church of England, in the case of the Queen, instead caving in to the pressures coming from society. It takes courage to stand up for the truth. Spiritual courage, that may be our greatest need, he says. He wrote in Malachi's message, without courage, the other virtues of God are of little value. What a statement. That's quite a statement. Without spiritual courage, what good are the other virtues of God? If you don't have the courage to walk with God, to fight for God, what good are these other virtues if we're just paralyzed with fear, if we're just frozen and we won't act? Brad McDonald gave a lecture a couple weeks ago, bringing out lessons. I think I might have touched on this last week, just bringing out lessons from the former prophet's booklet or book That's the program I just played a clip from, my father's program on the former prophets. But the one of the lessons that Brad McDonald was noting was how Joshua was the cause. He caused positive things to happen. He made it happen. My father wrote in the former prophet's book, he said here, put Joshua in charge and he will cause good things to happen in Israel. God wants us to do that as well. Cause positive things to happen and cause successes in our lives and in the lives of those we lead. And then there's this message or this quote from Herbert Armstrong. This is from one of his articles many years ago, talking about this partnership that you enter into with God at conversion and what it takes to obtain the victories that we seek as true Christians. Mr. Armstrong said, It is well to realize that the Bible reveals that God does for us what we are unable to do for ourselves. Usually, He will supply your need through your own efforts. But if you place confidence in Him, He'll see that the need comes. I mean, usually, this is the way God usually works through us. We've got to put forth the effort. We've got to be a cause for good. It's God in us. It's God's power that strengthens us. It's God's purpose and plan that brings forth a holy, righteous character. It's the sacrifice of Christ that even makes it possible for us to build the character of God, for us to be filled with the life of Christ. God does supply that extra help and power, but He also wants to see us individually putting forth the effort to cause positive things to happen. He wants you to do your part. He wants me to do my part. And so be a man of action. Be a woman of action. Not reckless action without any thought or planning or counsel or guidance coming from God and His family, His government. But be willing to act on what you hear on this program or what you read in the Trumpet magazine or what you see and hear on the Key of David program. It says back in Deuteronomy, notice what it says about Joshua. This is Deuteronomy 3 and verses 25 and 26. It says, I pray you, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon, but the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes. This is Moses saying why he couldn't enter into the promised land and would not hear me. And the Lord said to me, let it suffice you, speak no more unto me of this matter. So Moses pleaded with God that he'd be able to go in and conquer Canaan. But God said, no. It says in verse 27, this is Deuteronomy 3, get you up into the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward and behold it with your eyes, for you shall not go over this Jordan, but charge Joshua, listen to this, charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before this people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you shall see. Joshua would cause them to inherit it. That was God's assessment of this courageous man, this minister of Moses. He knew, just like my father said in the former prophet's book, he knew if you put Joshua in charge, look, he'll make it happen. He'll take care of this. In Deuteronomy 1, verse 37, it says, also the Lord was angry with me for your sake, saying, you also shall not go in there. But Joshua, here again, Joshua the son of Nun, which stands before me, he shall go in there. Encourage him, and he shall cause, there it is again, that word cause, He shall cause Israel to inherit it. God wants us, all of us, to be the cause of positive things. He wants to be able to use you. It's like I was discussing with the students this morning. I mean, he wants to get a big return on his investment. He wants to see us producing lots of fruit. We're being judged after all. God says we're going to be rewarded according to our works. God says that we reap what we sow. Well, this history with Joshua, it's pretty amazing when you study through his book and you see just how faithful he was, how powerfully God backed him up, parting the waters of the Jordan River, just like God had parted the waters of the Red Sea for Moses. He did the same miracle for Joshua. He backed him up. It says once they passed through the Jordan, then God spoke. This is Joshua 4 and verse 2. It says, take you 12 men out of the people, out of every tribe a man, and command you them, saying, take you hence out of the midst of the Jordan, out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm, 12 stones. So they were to basically construct this monument to serve as a reminder, to serve as a memorial, so that the children of Israel would never, ever forget these miraculous events, their miraculous history. Verse 9 of Joshua 4 says, and Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests, which bear the ark of the covenant, stood. And there they are there unto this day. So they erected this monument. They put up this monument to memorialize this fantastic miracle, this terrific intervention on God's part. I mean, we have a lot of monuments in these last two eras of God's church here in the last days. I mean, God has them all around us when you look at it spiritually, even physically, as he's raised up the ruins. What a testament to God's greatness and power. But coming back to Joshua 4 here, verse 10 says, for the priest, which bare the ark, stood in the midst of Jordan until everything was finished, that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak unto the people according to all that Moses commanded. And the people hasted and passed over. So here they were rallying around Joshua and the priesthood. This tremendous example, Joshua following all of the instructions of Moses. And it says in verse 14, on that day, the Lord magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they feared him as they feared Moses all the days of his life. God magnified his leader, this courageous man. God magnified Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and Israel rallied around him. That's the kind of impact courageous leadership can have. And that's the kind of reward, those are the kinds of blessings that God puts upon those who would step out in faith and courageously obey God and trust God. Valuable lessons through and through. Look at how, just to use that example of Winston Churchill, look at how he was magnified in the end. Where were all those critics from 1897 or 1898 that criticized him? Oh, you just want to go to India to get a name for yourself. You just want to go and fight in Egypt so that you can become a celebrity in the House of Commons. Well, in the end, in fact, he was courageous. He was a man of action. And God magnified him. I mean, even Winston Churchill, that history, it's alluded to there in the early verses of Ezekiel 33. Pretty amazing history. These are fantastic examples to look to, because this is a dark and evil world, and it's going to take courage and strength, spiritually speaking. It's going to take a special kind of trust and faith in God to endure all the way through to the end. In these trying times, you're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, suggestions, anything you'd like to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.